Today on Wings, a truck driver who cleaned up her union.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Unionization is making a comeback in North America as a legitimate part of the economic system. The new 2019 version of the North America Free Trade Agreement requires compliance with International Labor Organization standards, including the right to strike. Mexico has already ratified it and is making changes to its laws. As of November 28th, the U.S. Congress is still pondering the treaty. Canada must reintroduce the bill to ratify due to recent parliamentary elections, but a new attitude is being felt. Instead of legislating workers in vital services back on the job, Canadian governments have now begun expressing trust in the parties to work things out at the negotiating table. In November, that approach succeeded with a National Railroad workers' strike and a Vancouver Transit workers' job action. Part of effective negotiation is having democratic unions that represent the workers' genuine needs. Canadian truck driver Diana Kilmurray led that movement in the Teamsters Union decades ago. She told Wings how she did it shortly before a film on her life debuted in 1996.
Diana Kilmurray, International Vice President-at-Large of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, chairs the union's Human Rights Committee. Kilmurray's demands for an ethics committee in a union infamous for corruption earned her a place on the victorious reform slate of officers in 1991. In November 1996, the reformers must defend their accomplishments against a resurging old guard. Wings reached Diana Kilmurray at her Vancouver office by phone. The reporter is Carol Stahl.
We're speaking with Diana Kilmurray. How did you come to be affiliated with the Teamsters initially?
I became a truck driver at the age of 22 and joined the Teamsters in 1974. I belong to a large local union with 13,000 members in British Columbia and the Yukon Territory. And in 1976, about 2 years after I had become a member, a reform candidate for principal officer of the union ran for office, and I supported him. Jack Blachowicz was summarily removed from office by the old guard powers that be, so I didn't like it much and got involved in the struggle to reinstate the individual that the membership had voted into office, and, you know, frankly, there's not been a good time to quit since.
Let me ask you this. As a woman, how did you gain the respect of the men? This is largely a male union, I presume.
If you're speaking of the whole of the Teamsters Union, there are more men than women, but almost 400,000 of 1.4 million members are women. People tend to think of the Teamsters Union as the truck drivers' union, and it certainly is that, but it's much more, from airline attendants to San Diego zookeepers to police, teachers, civic workers, even the little characters at Disneyland are Teamsters. I can't think of one industry in which we don't represent members somewhere in North America. Local 213, when I joined it, was a heavy construction road building and pipeline local, and I was a heavy construction driver. Certainly I was the first female to work in the local in heavy construction. Local 213 now, like most locals, is a big miscellaneous local, and we have a lot of people involved in food processing and factories and the like. But in those industries that tend to be male-dominated, naturally the members tend to be predominantly male.
What was it about you that made them want to vote for you?
Well, I think one goes through a process of acceptance predicated on how you carry yourself as a fellow union member and your ability to do the job. I didn't have a lot of trouble. There is, of course, you know, the one or two guys out of 100 that seem to want to make something of the fact that you're female. But frankly, if you don't respond anybody trying to harass me in any way would generally be dealt with by the guys. And I would say the reason that the men subsequently would vote for me is, you know, I'd rather more education than many of them did, and they learned in a hurry that I wrote a pretty mean grievance and really cared about the union. And I mean, I don't think they care whether it's a female voice or a male voice, as long as a person seeking to represent them has the skills to represent them well.
You were the daughter of a doctor, is that right?
Yes.
And what prompted you to get involved in truck driving?
Well, because I was going to university and I got a job delivering auto parts, and I liked driving for a living, and then it was just a matter of driving something big enough that you would get paid enough money to support yourself. So I just went from a little truck to a bigger truck to a really big truck.
In 1981, there was a convention in Las Vegas.
Yeah, there's a convention every 5 years.
You had gotten together with a group of people with a slate. Would you talk a little about that?
There was a reform organization that came into being in 1976 called the Teamsters for a Democratic Union. And whatever abuses were going on in the union, a group of rank-and-file members, activists from all over North America, had agreed that the fundamental problem was the lack of democracy in the union and the inability of the membership to vote on those issues that concerned them, and specifically not being able to vote for the convention delegates or top officers and many other things. But the only place you can change the Constitution, which governs the union, is at the convention. But you can't go to the convention if you're a rank-and-file member, because the Constitution says you can't. So it's a perfect catch-22. Local 213, precisely, it's almost poetic justice, precisely because they had removed Lahavec, a number of the people who would otherwise have gotten to go to the convention automatically had to, under U.S. law, stand for office. So that was just one of a handful of locals in out of some 700 locals that make up the Teamsters Union in which that was possible. You know, one was able to run as a delegate, and we got elected, and off to the Teamster Convention we went.
And what happened at that convention?
Well, I had spent about 6 months reading through various ethical practices, devices in other unions, in the AFL-CIO, and I felt that it was important to make the statement that a union is a sacred trust to provide for the membership to aggressively promote their wages and working conditions. So I had written up a constitutional amendment that if you were convicted of labor extortion, which is essentially selling out the membership to the employer for money, that you would be summarily removed from office. And you wouldn't think you would have to make an amendment like that in a trade union. But I can tell you, when I put the Ethical Practices Commission amendment on the floor of the Teamsters, there were some people in disagreement. I mean, there was 2,000 of them, and there was 20 of us.
How did they respond?
Well, they were yelling and screaming and booing and hissing and all the things that you might imagine.
Did you ever fear for your safety? Did you ever receive threats?
Well, you know, I've gotten lots of threats over the years, but basically people that phone you up to tell you that they're going to kill you or not going to kill you. I mean, you know, if somebody's going to pop you, well, then they're going to pop you. I've often considered the leadership to be evil. I never thought they were particularly stupid. And when eliminating you, as it were, will not accomplish their ends, as a matter of fact would tend to make things greatly worse, what's the point of doing it?
Since you've been vice president, you've had to deal with your reform, that is, slashing salaries and getting rid of multiple pensions among union officials?
Well, one of the worst abuses, you know, which I tend to refer to as the wretched excess of the previous administrations, was this practice of pyramiding salaries. Now, a member in a local union authorizes by way of a vote what the officers are paid. So say you were the head of a local union, you might be getting a salary of $60,000 or $70,000, but then you could become a joint council officer and you would get another salary. And then if you were, you know, a regional body officer, well, then you'd get another salary. Then if you work for the international or one of the trade divisions or whatever, and we ended up with people making $525,000 a year who had 4, 5, and 6 pension plans sometime. I mean, if you're in it for the money, then go work for management who tends to work on that principle. I'm not opposed to union officials being paid a reasonable sum, but there is no trade unionist in the world that should be making $525,000 a year. It is just absolutely wrong. That was a platform that we had run on since the inception of TDU, and it's one which Ron Kerry adopted when he made his bid for the general presidency, when we won the direct election of the top officers of the union. While we don't have the direct ability to tell a joint council what it will pay people, we do have the ability to say that if you want to work for the international union, then you're only going to get one salary. Ron Kerry has cut his own salary by $75,000. So, you know, not only do we implement that policy, we practice it ourselves. And I would say the overwhelming majority of the members are very satisfied with the reforms that we've instituted. And if there's any criticism, is that we haven't done enough fast enough. But it's a very big unit. It's very complex. Times are hard, and, you know, some things are beyond resolution, things that should have been done 15 years ago that were not done, that, you know, for example, allowed the non-union trucking sector to grow. You just can't put that genie back in the bottle because you won an election. And we've done everything that we know how in the way of becoming, you know, financially stripped down and sleek and, you know, educating our membership so that they don't beat up on one another, so they understand the forces that are grinding on them. And, you know, I wish I had a magic wand and I could just return it to the great glory days of Senior Hoffa. But I don't know anybody that can make it go back to the 50s. It's not the 50s. It's 1996 and times are hard. You're up against transnational corporations.
Now, you've been with the Teamsters for a long time. You must have witnessed a lot of changes over the years. How has women's participation in unions or in the Teamsters affected the politics?
The most startling aspect to that is, of course, when a person becomes a local union officer in their 20s, they tend to hang on to those jobs for the next 40 years till they retire. Mm-hmm. And what was starting to happen is that you would have large numbers of females in a particular local that was run entirely by men. I mean, all the officers were men because prior to them coming on stream, most of the workers were men. And what we've been doing is educating our women members. And, you know, at your peril these days, would you run a slate for a local union office or hire a business agent for a largely female workplace that was not a woman or Hispanic, whether it's a concentration of race or gender?
Are the unions responding to the women's salary needs as much as to men's?
Well, see, that's the problem of society, isn't it? I mean, a truck driver makes $18 an hour because it's a job that's done by men. Whereas a woman who is working equally hard, doing work of equal value to society, is in a $10 an hour job. So insofar that you can take $10 an hour jobs and make them into $11.50 an hour job, well, the union does that. I mean, we're pretty good at negotiating contracts. For all the warts of the Teamsters Union, I have to tell you that you'd be hard-pressed to find another union that's as effective at getting people decent contracts. What is difficult to do is to take a whole group of workers, a whole class of workers, and make them make as much money as a truck driver. And that's because society itself just puts different value on work done by women as opposed to men. Mm-hmm. And we can hardly go into a workplace in which, say, people are packing potato chips and the entire industry, be it union or non-union, is in and around the $9, $10, $11 range and say, okay, well, the Teamsters are here and we believe in equal pay for women, so you're going to pay all your workers $18 an hour. Well, it's not going to happen. A, if the company were to agree to that, they'd be out of business tomorrow because all of their competition would be paying $11 an hour. Mm-hmm. And B, if you try to hold the company's feet to the fire, those people would be out on strike, you know, to the end of time.
Mm-hmm. During past airline strikes, flight attendants supported strikes by pilots and machinists. Yet when they tried to strike, did not seem to have the support of the pilots or the machinists.
The strategy in negotiations when you have a multi-trade group of a single employer, there is stages at which, say, the pilot's contract is negotiated. For example, if you can remember back to the time when the air traffic controllers were out on strike, obviously what would have won that strike is if the pilots had supported them. But the company is not stupid, you see. I mean, they always get the people that they absolutely cannot do without, and it's pretty hard to fly planes without pilots.
Mm-hmm.
But if the company is able to get the one segment negotiated and put to bed when it's the next person's turn out, unfortunately, there's not always a cooperation between the various unions in any given collective agreement. And that's got nothing to do with ethics or male or female. That just has to do with who's got the stroke on the job.
Is there going to be a revolution by labor? Is something going to change? Are they going to regain the power of the old?
Oh, I think so, because you cannot live on $9 an hour. You just can't do it. You can stay in mommy and daddy's basement if you're lucky and you have a daddy, and that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And there are huge numbers, people that obeyed all the rules. They went to school, they did well in college, middle management people. And industry says now, surprise, we're downsizing, and they're out on the street, and they're 50 mm-hmm. years old. The entire workforce has come to see what lean and mean means. And
mm-hmm.
it is my hope that eventually the working class, when they eventually realize that that middle manager and the guy that's making widgets on the production line all work for someone else and ergo are in fact workers, are going to realize that, you know, the country and the economy is being dragged in a direction mm-hmm. that is bad for the country. All of those people are consumers, and unless society gets to the point of meanness where you're just going to line hungry people up and shoot them down in the street, then it's much better to have them working, being productive, paying their taxes, paying their share of the schools, the jails, etc., etc., than to have good people without jobs. Mm-hmm. And when those people stop making money, they stop consuming.
Right.
I mean, it's the most short-sighted, stupid philosophy. And it's not that I think the people that run the world are particularly stupid. I just think they're enormously greedy, and they're going to crush even yet more sectors of the economy to the point, you know, like Bobby McGee says, freedom is when you got nothing left to lose. And boy, the American workforce is getting pretty close to that.
But how does the multinational corporation situation figure into this?
See, now, your neighbor living beside you has got a job. He's got a union job, a pension plan, a health and welfare plan, and is making a reasonable living. His wife is working, too, and, you know, they care about their children, and they're being sent to college. Now, if you, as the next-door neighbor, you say, well, now, this guy makes cars, so I'm going to make it possible for you to buy a car that is made by people making $7 a day in the maquiladora in Mexico, or I'm going to allow you to buy clothing made by slave and child labor in Taiwan or China or wherever. If you don't think that eventually that is going to have a consequence to you, what are you going to do with that next door neighbor? What are you going to do with the children? Who gets the money? I could see if the sweater costs $4, but it doesn't. It still costs $100. So instead of that money being put into the hands of the many, those the people that make it, who then pay their taxes and contribute to the economy, you stick it in the hands of a multinational corporation who has no allegiance to any political system other than unmitigated greed and couldn't care less about you, your family, your country, the environment in which you live, or anything else except the almighty bottom dollar.
You're saying then that people need to organize internationally if they're going to organize.
Right. The trouble is that with things like NAFTA, you know, the Mexican government, they still regularly terrorize union members down there. The labor laws of the United States are crummy. The labor laws of Mexico are non-existent. If you do belong to a union, you're allowed to belong to a state-controlled union, which is essentially negotiating with itself. I mean, if there were real unions down there, they wouldn't be making $7 a day.
If you go down even to Guatemala and the rest of Latin America, you see a lot of the union members have taken a huge hit in the past few years. A lot of people killed.
Well, indeed. Corporate America, or corporate the world, were nasties in the 30s when they were organizing Big Steel and the auto workers and whatever. They shot our grandparents down in the street. And it shouldn't be any surprise to you in these, you know, banana republic-run countries that they're shooting trade unions down in the street today. They're not shooting us down in the streets yet. Mm-hmm. Because they can do it via economic terrorism, that mm-hmm. all that you have built up, all of the successive generations of workers and their unions that have fought and died in the wars that have contributed to society, corporate America is now saying, well, we don't need you. Thank you very much for making us wealthy beyond all means, but we just don't need you, and we're going to reject you. And even though the workers of the United States are the most productive workers in the world by everybody's estimates, even that of corporate America, we're going to come along and tell you that you're not competitive with people making $7 a day. Well, that's right. You're not competitive with people making $7 a day, but at the end, when you come full circle, how many Chevy Novas is the guy making $7 a day going to buy?
So you think this is going to change in the next few years, that labor is going to regain some footing?
Yes, I think we're starting to already. I mean, people mm-hmm. that 10 years ago might have said, oh, well, you know, unions were needed in the 30s. Now, out of two city blocks, you know, half the people have been downsized, replaced, terminated, given early retirement, and there's all these bodies in the street. You can't go to the bank anymore, assuming that you still have a job, without tripping over the homeless. Who the hell do you think the homeless are? I mean, there's not some, you know, baby farm cranking out homeless people. They were former productive members of society that have just fallen on hard times and fallen through the cracks. I mean, anybody that saw the Depression in the 30s, and when I talked to the older guys in the union, it's no different. People don't want to see the homeless, and they don't want to see what that represents. But all of them are pretty much one or two paychecks away from being about in the same position. And when you get enough of those people on the edge like that, your house that you spend, you know, whatever houses are worth down where you're at, say $200,000, well, there's nobody that's got $200,000 to buy your house, and there's nobody that's got $10,000 to buy your car. Mm-hmm. And then you end in a depression. And I know that is going to happen just as sure as night follows day, but I would rather not go through the exercise. So I spend all of my working hours trying to convince the people of the world to smarten up and, you know, recognize what has happened in history before, what is happening to them now, and quit blaming the guy beside you, and instead fix your sights on, you know, the politicians and the transnational corporations and the people who are already making $30 million a year and want to make $60 million a year.
So what are your plans for the future?
Fighting the war.
Okay.
Right.
What about this movie? Have you seen it?
No, I haven't. As a matter of fact, I'm going to a screening shortly.
Mm-hmm.
It's not finished yet. It's in its rough cut form. So.
And it's basically a representation of your life and work?
Yes.
Who do they have playing?
Well, very interesting, you may or may not be aware that Senator Tom Hayden, his former wife was Jane Fonda. Well, they've divorced, and his new wife is Barbara Williams, and that's who plays me.
How do you feel about that?
I think she did a stupendous job. I wasn't around every day, of course, because I have other things to do, but on the several occasions that I dropped in whilst they were shooting the movie, I thought she was doing an excellent job. She's certainly a very gifted actress.
Did you have any input on the final script?
Oh, you bet. I had an entertainment lawyer draw that up because I certainly didn't need to have a bad movie made of my life's work, as it were. You know, I didn't need to have any movie made, but being that they wanted to make one, they were going to make the actual story of the struggle to reform the Teamsters Union. You know, I can tell you that about 7 or 8 scripts got nuked right at the start because they were, you know, making Betsy Boop meets the mob and didn't accurately represent what actually happened. So,
One of the articles mentioned that the money that you received from the film, you gave it back to the Teamsters, or you gave it to the Teamsters. Is that correct?
Well, I gave it to the Teamsters for a Democratic Union,
the reform group.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this. Is it time to change the name International Brotherhood of Teamsters?
Right. See, that's in the Constitution, so you can't change it until the convention.
Uh-huh.
But clearly it should be the Teamsters International Union, and, you know, in our day-to-day activities, that's how we refer to it. But unfortunately, we're a legal entity, so we have to keep the International Brotherhood until it's changed by the convention delegates.
Are you working on that?
Well, everybody's in agreement. I mean, I can't find anybody that wants to stand up in 1996 and say, oh, no, let's keep it the Brotherhood.
Uh-huh. You had a women's Teamster convention in 1994.
Right. There had been one held before, but it was somewhat of a, you know, women's auxiliary type of an effort. Ours was a hard-hitting, action-packed conference for women Teamsters, and was well attended, and people were just ecstatic over the opportunity to network with one another and hone their skills and the like. And just last year, in September of 95, we held the first ever civil rights conference, and, you know, are continuing to hold both women's and civil rights conferences on a regional basis to make them more accessible to the rank and file.
Well, thank you very much, Diana Kilmarie.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye.
Wings reporter Carol Stahl interviewed Diana Kilmarie of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters in 1996. According to Statistics Canada, more than half the country's union members now are women. The award-winning CBC film about her, now titled Mother Trucker, can be found on YouTube. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our website wingsradio.org. Thanks to all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the new book, The Maternal Roots of the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Lee Bana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.